Today is Thursday, July 10th, and this is the World Socialist Website. The Texas Flood Disaster, Trump's Hurricane Katrina, by Patrick Martin. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said Tuesday that more than 170 people remain missing in the Hill Country flooding, while the official death toll stands at 119. With no survivors found since last Friday, the final toll is expected to approach 300, making it the deadliest disaster in the continental United States since Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Despite efforts by government officials to deflect blame, the catastrophe along the Guadalupe River was not a natural disaster, but the product of decades of social decay and political reaction. The needless deaths of nearly 300 people, many of them young girls, are the direct result. Those who uphold this system, like President Trump and Governor Abbott, have blood on their hands. Trump plans to visit the flood zone Friday, making a phony display of concern 8 years after his first administration rejected Kerr County's application for a federal grant to build a flood warning system. At the White House, Trump dismissed any link between the disaster and the major cuts to the National Weather Service, or NWS, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, implemented since he took office in January, despite reports that two NWS offices in Central Texas were severely understaffed. Trump has shut down any federal programs addressing climate change and effectively banned research into global warming. Yet, there is ample evidence that climate change played a major role in the Texas floods. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, releasing it in record amounts, such as the 18 to 20 inches of rain that fell in parts of the Hill Country. In Kerr County, more water fell in 4 hours than flows over Niagara Falls in a full day, overwhelming the Guadalupe River and sweeping away dozens of summer camps, RVs, and homes. Texas embodies the degradation of American capitalism, where staggering inequality is combined with political reaction and brutality, despite, or rather because of, the immense wealth accumulated by billionaires in oil, gas, tech, weapons, ranching, and healthcare, the social conditions facing the majority of Texans are among the worst in the country. According to the annual ranking conducted by CNBC, Texas was the worst of the 50 states in terms of quality of life in 2024, after having ranked 49th in the three previous years. The state ranks 49th in terms of the proportion of adults who are high school graduates, 48th in terms of child health, and 50th in the proportion of the population covered by health insurance. Unemployment benefits are so low that Texas workers recoup only 10% of average living costs if they are laid off, according to Oxfam. Nearly 43% of Texas households struggle to afford basic necessities such as housing, childcare, and health care. And 14.2% of Texans live below the abysmally inadequate federal poverty line. The state ranks 45th in state expenditures per capita, and little of that spending goes into public social services. Particularly in rural and inner-city areas, there is a high level of social vulnerability due to factors like poverty, unemployment, poor education, and discrimination against minority Black and Hispanic populations, who actually make up the majority of the state's people. Healthcare is a particularly critical deficit. According to the United Health Foundation, Texas is near the bottom, with only 182 primary care providers per 100,000 residents. One-fifth of all Texas adults with a credit score have medical debt that has gone to collection. Abortion has been illegal in Texas since the Supreme Court decision in 2022, and the state pays a bounty for information leading to the arrest of healthcare workers and others who assist them in providing abortion services. While social services are starved, state funds are lavished on the forces of repression, the state police, the Texas Rangers, the Texas State Guard, and the National Guard, much of it deployed as part of Abbott's Operation Lone Star, an $11 billion anti-immigrant rampage in which state forces have joined with ICE and CPB to round up and imprison migrant workers. Texas maintains a vast prison system, the largest in the United States. The state has 8% of the U.S. population, but accounts for 33% of all U.S. executions. The law and order frenzy is bipartisan. In the major cities of Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin, all run by Democratic mayors, the police departments take up the lion's share of funding, frequently more than all social services combined. In terms of physical infrastructure, the state's performance is perhaps even worse than on social benefits, if that is possible. Only a few months ago, the Texas State Senate blocked legislation to establish a statewide emergency response plan at a cost of $500 million. This would have been directed at protecting the population, not only from flash flooding, but wildfires, tornadoes, and hurricanes, all of which are common in the state. A survey conducted by the state government last year identified more than $50 billion in flood control needs, but the state government has provided only $1.4 billion, less than 3% of what is required. Infrastructure spending represents less than 0.5% of the $322 billion state budget. This particularly affects rural areas like the flood zone along the Guadalupe River. Texas has 84 billionaires, with a combined net worth of $722 billion, but no personal income tax, no corporate income tax, no estate tax, and no inheritance tax. This has made it a haven for enormous private wealth, side by side with dire poverty and abysmal living condition. The world's richest man, Elon Musk, at $342 billion, lives in Texas, as well as Michael Dell at $101 billion, founder of the computer manufacturer, Alice Walton, $101 billion, one of the heirs to the Walmart fortune, and a lengthy list of oil barons, financiers, and property developers. The entirely preventable Texas catastrophe embodies the social policies of the Trump administration. It is the outcome of government by and for the financial oligarchy, the combination of anti-scientific bigotry with brutal austerity. Many of the people who fell victim to this disaster likely voted for Trump, but they are now confronting, through bitter experience, the consequences of the policies he champions. But Trump is not an individual aberration. He is the expression of a class. His administration arises out of decades of political degeneration, presided over by both Republicans and Democrats, in which trillions were funneled into the hands of the super rich while the country's infrastructure collapsed. Through their vast wealth, the oligarchs control the economy, making it impossible to develop or implement a rational scientific response to climate change and environmental disaster. They control the political system, buying and selling congressmen and senators, governors and presidents, and using the courts to uphold their property rights. The Socialist Equality Party fights to arm the working class with a revolutionary program to take political power and reorganize society on a socialist foundation. This requires a complete break with the corporate-controlled Democratic and Republican parties and the building of new organizations of struggle, rank-and-file workplace committees, neighborhood action groups, and a mass political movement to unify workers across all industries and regions. The central lesson of the Texas flood is that the most basic requirements of a modern society are incompatible with the system that subordinates everything to the enrichment of a financial oligarchy. The immense resources hoarded by the super rich must be expropriated and used to meet urgent social needs, including safe housing and infrastructure, universal health care and education, climate adaptation, and disaster preparedness. This must be the new point of departure for the struggles of American workers, the fight to reorganize economic life according to a socialist program based not on profit, but on social need and democratic control. top Democratic Party officials escalate baseless charges of anti-Semitism against New York mayoral candidate Mondani by Fred Mazzellis. 2 weeks after Democratic Socialists of America member Zohran Mamdani's upset victory in the New York City Democratic mayoral primary, the election has emerged as a focal point of national politics. Mamdani has become the target of near-daily denunciations and threats from Donald Trump and the fascist right, and a substantial section of the Democratic Party is working actively to ensure his defeat in November. In the latest effort by sections of the Democratic Party establishment to block Mamdani in November, despite his own assurances that he will not threaten business interests, several Democratic members of Congress have launched baseless accusations of anti-Semitism. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Florida congresswoman who led the Democratic National Committee's attack on Bernie Sanders in 2016, denounced Mamdani for refusing to disavow the slogan "Globalize the Intifada," calling it, quote, "dangerous rhetoric that would fan the flames of evil," unquote. Wasserman Schultz made the statement to The Hill. A staunch supporter of the Israeli genocide in Gaza, she has had nothing to say about the ongoing mass murder that has taken over 57,000 Palestinian lives, including thousands of women and children. The Hill also solicited criticisms of Mamdani from Jared Moskowitz of Florida and Brad Schneider of Illinois, both Jewish Democrats. The publication appears to have only approached Jewish lawmakers, part of the broader effort to conflate the interests of the Zionist regime with those of the Jewish people and slander opposition to the genocide as anti-Semitism. Former New York Governor David Paterson held a press conference in Midtown Manhattan on July 7th, calling on the four other candidates to unite against Mamdani. He urged them to, quote, "find a way to unite behind one of them," unquote, but declined to offer a prediction or preference on who that unity candidate should be. Paterson left office nearly 15 years ago, having never been elected, but finishing the term of Eliot Spitzer after Spitzer resigned in a prostitution scandal. His press conference was notable for the presence of two vocal Trump supporters, billionaire grocery magnate John Katsimatidis and radio host Sidney Rosenberg. Mamdani enters the general election with a significant advantage, as Democrats outnumber Republicans in New York City by a 6-to-1 margin. Eric Adams is running as an independent, having skipped the Democratic primary after corruption charges against him were dropped by the Trump Justice Department in a quid pro quo. Andrew Cuomo, who lost to Mamdani by a humiliating 12-point margin despite spending $30 million, largely from billionaires like Michael Bloomberg and hedge fund CEO Bill Ackman, a vocal Trump supporter, has also left open the possibility of an independent run. The remaining candidates are lawyer Jim Walden and Republican Curtis Sliwa, who founded the notorious vigilante anti-crime group The Guardian Angels decades ago. Cuomo and Adams exchanged public barbs this week. Adams, as reported by Politico, said Cuomo was the one obstacle standing in the way of a second term. While insisting that Cuomo should abandon the race, he also said that the former mayor had asked the same of him. Quote, "I'm the sitting mayor of the city of New York, and you expect me to step aside when you just lost to Zohran for 12 points," he proclaimed. In his usual turn to racialist politics when in a tight spot, Adams added the complaint that Cuomo was well known for undermining black candidates for political office. Both Adams and Cuomo have seized on a 16-year-old application to Columbia University to attack their rival. Mamdani had checked boxes indicating he was of both Asian and African or African-American ancestry. He later explained that the form offered no option to reflect his actual background, born in Uganda to parents of Indian descent, so he, quote, "checked multiple boxes trying to indicate the fullness of my background," unquote. In response, Adams employed racialist demagogy, declaring, quote, "the African-American identity is not a checkbox of convenience," unquote, and called on Columbia to release the full application. The document only came to light due to a data breach carried out by a right-wing eugenicist hacker. Cuomo joined in with a spokesperson calling for it to be, quote, fully investigated, because if true, it could be fraud and just the tip of the iceberg, unquote. Amid the flurry of denunciations, Mamdani has gained support from sections of the political establishment. Brooklyn Democratic Chair Rodnissy Bishote-Hermelin and Manhattan Chair Keith L.T. Wright both endorsed him, as did Manhattan Congressman Gerald Nadler, who backed Mamdani immediately after the primary. Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin, a prominent figure in the National Party's progressive wing, also urged others to support the victor. Several major union bureaucracies that had backed Cuomo in the primary, including the Hotel Trades Council and Local 32BJ of the Building Service Employees, have now shifted their support to Mamdani. The United Federation of Teachers, which had previously withheld an endorsement, citing a divided membership, has also come out in support of Mamdani. The union bureaucrats, an integral part of the Democratic Party, are endorsing Mamdani because they expect him to become the next mayor and plan on doing business with him, and that business will include close collaboration and the betrayal of their own members. The opposition to Mamdani from within the political establishment has less to do with the policies he proposes, centered on a series of minor reforms, than the broad political radicalization expressed in the support for his campaign, including opposition to extreme social inequality and the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Mamdani's own response to the campaign of denunciations and threats has been to shift to the right, stressing his willingness to work with business leaders to explain why his politics, quote, will benefit all, unquote, as he put it in an interview last month. Last week, the Wall Street Journal published a revealing piece titled, "The Mamdani Millionaire Supporting the Socialist for New York City Mayor." It quoted venture capitalist Bradley Tusk, Bloomberg's 2009 campaign manager, restaurateur Keith McNally, and others. Their motive is clear. They are happy to pay an extra 2% in taxes, what they call their fair share, as a negligible cost to them and a form of insurance against a broader social explosion. Among those multimillionaires who recognize that the current crisis, especially as it is exacerbated by Trump's policies, can only end with a crash, Mamdani looks like a safe bet. Catherine Wild, the longtime spokeswoman for big business as the head of the Partnership for New York, told the Journal that she had met with Mamdani almost a year ago when he was just getting started on his campaign. She said, quote, "He said, look, I'm not in favor of government taking over your business. He made clear that he's not anti-capitalist in that sense." And, quote, U.S. Supreme Court permits Trump to move ahead with mass layoffs and destruction of federal agencies, by Kevin Reed. In an attack on workers' democratic and social rights, the Supreme Court of the United States, or SCOTUS, has cleared the way for the Trump administration to proceed with mass layoffs of federal employees. The tens of thousands of job cuts target the infrastructure of government and public services. The focus of the assault by the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, formerly led by billionaire oligarch Elon Musk. The decision, which overrides a lower court injunction, marks a new stage in the offensive by the Trump administration against U.S. government services dating back to the New Deal reforms that were implemented to forestall social revolution in the 1930s. On July 8th, the Supreme Court lifted a lower court ruling that temporarily blocked Trump's sweeping plans to lay off federal workers across more than 20 agencies. The unsigned SCOTUS order, supported by the court's right-wing majority, as well as liberal justices Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, allows the administration to resume its efforts to reorganize and scale back the federal government while the legal challenge proceeds. The order does not decide the underlying legality of Trump's executive order announcing the elimination of the jobs or the specific agency reduction plans. Instead, the court claims the government is, quote, likely to succeed, unquote, in its argument that the executive order and related directives are within presidential authority. The court majority states, quoting, "We express no view on the legality of any agency reduction in force and reorganization plan produced or approved pursuant to the executive order and memorandum. The district court enjoined further implementation or approval of the plans based on its view about the illegality of the executive order and memorandum, not on any assessment of the plans themselves. Those plans are not before this court," end quote. As it has done in other recent critical decisions, SCOTUS refused to address the substance of the matter while granting Trump precisely what he wanted, the green light to proceed with his fascist agenda. The Supreme Court's order is notably terse, offering little in the way of legal language. There is no engagement with the catastrophic real-world consequences of the layoffs or the constitutional questions raised by the lower courts. The lower court decision, issued by U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston in San Francisco, had temporarily blocked the layoffs, saying that Trump had exceeded his authority by ordering mass firings and reorganizations without congressional approval, which is required for agencies created and funded by Congress. The judge asserted this critical element of constitutional checks and balances, noting that the executive cannot unilaterally dismantle the federal government. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson stood alone in dissent, issuing a rebuke and warning to the nation. She wrote, quoting, "Given the fact-based nature of the issue in this case and the many serious harms that result from allowing the president to dramatically reconfigure the federal government, it was eminently reasonable for the court to maintain the status quo while the courts evaluate the lawfulness of the president's executive action." Jackson accused the majority of allowing Trump to take a wrecking ball to the federal bureaucracy. Again, quoting, "At bottom, this case is about whether that action amounts to a structural overhaul that usurps Congress's policymaking prerogatives, and it is hard to imagine deciding that question in any meaningful way after those changes have happened. Yet, for some reason, this court sees fit to step in now and release the president's wrecking ball at the outset of this litigation." Her dissent points to the court's ongoing abdication of its responsibility to defend the constitutional separation of powers and protect the public from executive abuse. The case originated in a wave of lawsuits filed by states and labor unions after Trump's February executive order mandating mass layoffs and agency downsizing. Attorneys general from Washington, D.C., and 19 states argued that federal agencies were violating the law by firing probationary employees under the pretense of poor performance when they were executing a politically motivated far-right reduction of the workforce. The states warned that these actions would devastate regional economies and public services, as federal law requires advance notice and coordination for mass layoffs to mitigate economic dislocation. The layoffs target departments including agriculture, commerce, health and human services, state, treasury, and veterans affairs. Experts and state officials warned that the cuts would disrupt essential services such as health care, food safety, and veterans benefits, create cascading instability in local economies reliant on federal employment, and overwhelm state support systems as displaced workers seek assistance. Arthur Wheaton, director of labor studies at Cornell University, cautioned, quote, "It will not save a lot of money if they try to maintain the same level of service, so you may be getting less from the smaller workforce. It's going to be real expensive for the lawsuits and the fights that are going to go on for the long term, and it creates an incredible amount of tension and stress within the system, which is partly by design," end quote. Federal workers themselves report deep anxiety and exhaustion, with many contemplating early retirement or fearing for the future of their departments. The layoffs, already affecting over 10,000 workers, threaten to cripple agencies like Veterans Affairs, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Environmental Protection Agency. The dire impact of staff reductions has already been manifested in the death and the destruction caused by the flooding in Texas, where the National Weather Service was ill-prepared to warn the public due to understaffing and a lack of critical resources. The response of federal government employee unions, particularly the American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE, and the AFL-CIO, has been characterized solely by legal maneuvering and appeals to the courts, without any mass mobilization of the workers. When the layoffs were first announced, the unions filed lawsuits and issued statements, but refused to organize strikes or workplace actions that would mobilize the broader working class against the Trump administration in defense of jobs and services. This strategy, rooted in the union's alliance with the Democratic Party, has proven bankrupt. The unions have preferred to rely on legal appeals and negotiations with the very political establishment that is complicit in the assault on public sector jobs. This has left the working class vulnerable and without any effective means of resisting the deadly impact of the destruction of government infrastructure and the vital services it provides. The Democratic Party has played a critical role in enabling the Trump administration's offensive. In March, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announced that he would vote to keep the government running by supporting a Republican-led continuing resolution, providing Trump with the votes needed to avert a shutdown and continue his policies. Schumer insisted a shutdown would be worse than giving Trump the means to further attack federal employees. This maneuver, combined with the Democrats' reliance on stunts and legal challenges with little hope of success, has allowed Trump and his fascist Republican allies to push through their big, beautiful bill, a massive transfer of wealth to the billionaire elite, which balloons the federal deficit while destroying public services and kicking more than 11 million workers off Medicaid. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.